Okay, well, here we are at the United Lodge of Theosophists. I see everybody paid attention to the time change that's here. And those that didn't have probably already left in frustration. But it was nice to get an extra hour of rest, we think, last night. So, we are one of over two dozen lodges on all the continents that are occupied, including Africa, throughout the world, the program is the same. It's independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, which is the recognition that all life is connected, that there is a universal brotherhood, which includes all of nature. It's just a matter of consciousness and degree. So in order to promulgate the teachings of theosophy, we do not proselytize, but we spread broadcast the teachings of theosophy. We have a Sunday morning meeting from 11 to 12, and the doors open at 10:30. This Sunday, this month, which is a new month, we are going to be discussing all month basic theosophical principles. Today it is self-evident theosophical principles. Next week, the foundation and law of brotherhood. So we will talk about brotherhood today as well, because that's what we do. But it'll be going into more detail during next week's class. So on Wednesday evenings, the doors open at 5:15. The library is open from 5:15 until 7:15. There's a student there if you'd like to ask any questions about the library. It's not a lending library. It's a reference library. So there's always a part for the class on the ocean of theosophy, which we're studying. We've been studying from September through June. So you can study the part for the evening, and there's also a reference which will give you a little more insight into the part for the evening. We have a book table that's open before and after the meetings, and we sell straight line theosophical works at cost. Most everything is online now as well, so you can go on our website or the Phoenix website, which we link to, and it's really a treasure trove. So the meeting begins on Wednesdays at 7:30 and ends promptly at 8:30. Now, all the efforts here are voluntary efforts of time, money, and service. Nothing is imposed or implied. We do not pass a basket or directly ask for any kind of donations, but they are gratefully accepted, and you can make a donation at the book table if you like, or there's on the barrister cases on the right, on the way out the door, there's a little box where you can use that as well. So, we would now like to read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. This is really our guide. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So, when it comes to the basic principles of theosophy, we have three fundamental propositions. These are axioms. You can look at these as postulates. We do not put them forth as "this is truth" with all capital letters, but because that would be, in a sense, that would be coercion, that would be dogma. So we do not, the beliefs that we have, we can hold private beliefs, of course, but we never say, "this you must believe." You may have a seat. Thank you. Make me nervous back there. So these ideas were given to us by the keepers, who were the masters of wisdom. And these are human beings who, like ourselves, except they have, in a sense, fully flowered, and they are bearing the fruit of these ideas, of these timeless, eternal ideas. We often say ancient, but it's really timeless. These ideas are always in existence, but sometimes they go into obscuration, and they're, you know, fortunately we are not in one of those times right now. We are here, you know, in a free country where we're allowed to express our views openly and not have to worry about an Inquisition coming along, and we all know about that. In the Dark Ages, many people died for these ideas. If they were honest about their feelings and they expressed them, there was great danger. So secrecy was the watchword. But there are always those teachers and their disciples who test, check, and verify these propositions, because they are axioms, and we need to make them real for ourselves. We need to make them a living power in our lives. We shouldn't even say we need to make them. We should just say, it is, we don't even know the word. It's a good idea. It's a good idea to consider these ideas and to try to make them part of ourselves. So so we have deity, which is the first fundamental. Deity is an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, immutable principle upon which all speculation is futile, because it is infinite and we have finite minds. But yet, even though we say all speculation is futile, it's like, well, how can we not do that? So we need to just look at the interconnectedness of all life. there's like there's chain after chain of life that's interconnected. Now, this deity being a principle, it's not a thing. It's not a gigantic male. It's not the god of the main religious of their tenets, because they put forth human attributes, and in a sense, the deity has no attributes of itself, and yet is the substratum of all and the basis of all, and it is always there, whether there is manifestation or there's a period of pralaya, when all the manifested universe goes back into one, and there's equal periods of like day or night. So the second fundamental is cycles. It's karma and reincarnation. We are all aware of cycles, especially when there's a change in the seasons, we think. We see in the fall, we see the beautiful leaves, the colors changing, and we realize that it's, you know, that autumn is here and that winter is coming. And there are cycles of life, like, which, you know, there's youth, there's middle age, there's old age, and we look at these cycles. There's really infancy, youth, age, which is middle age, and then there's, you know, the latter part of our life, which one could consider the winter of one's life. But in nature, we have the four seasons, and in the winter, that is when everything seems to be dead. That is actually when things are most alive, because the seeds are in the ground, and they thrill. The seeds thrill, and they burst forth in the spring. So there's much activity in the winter time. So we have day and night. We have sleeping and waking. And we have the four cycles of life. Everything is dual in manifestation. So the second fundamental being cycles, which includes law, it includes karma and reincarnation. Now, karma meaning strictly action. It's not, you know, we talk about good karma and bad karma, but that's because we kind of look at the finiteness of it all. And if we're looking at the basis of just one life, then it seems unfair, because we think, well, I didn't do that. Why do I deserve this? And that truly is the main reason we think that people search for and find these lofty ideas that we discuss in this room, because life often seems unfair. You know, the rich, by perhaps being born into it and no merit of their own, have all this, you know, this power and wealth. And the poor, who are often very good people and really generous with what little they have. So we have to look at the vast scheme of things, that reincarnation is a result of karma. We set up causes. There are those who do remember past lives, and we are told, although we can't say this is a fact because we can't remember our past lives, but there comes a point when one can remember one's past lives. So in the meantime, we need to look at this one life and just do the most we can to be as altruistic as we possibly can. So reincarnation and karma is a universal process. It's something that all natures, well, we see the re-embodiment of nature through the seasons. So the third fundamental proposition is called evolution. The universe exists for a purpose and there is evolution of soul. Now, there are no privileges or special gifts. It is all through effort and merit. If there were privileges and special gifts, then there would be favoritism. And in religion, people pray that something won't happen or pray for something to happen. But, you know, they're praying to an outside God. And it's very, like, really looking for special favors. But that is not fair. And so, you know, we don't engage in that in theosophy. So there's no privileges or special gifts. And the universe exists for the experience and evolution of the soul. So human evolution is the pivotal doctrine. It's where we attain to self-consciousness. There is consciousness throughout all the kingdoms, all the visible and invisible kingdoms. And we carry them with us. We have the vegetable, the mineral, the animal, and the human. The human is has the light of Manas, which the word man comes from Manas, and it's the thinking principles. We are mind beings. We are thinking beings. And we have choice. We have free will and choice. Whereas in the lower kingdoms, it's through impulse. It's through natural impulse. They react on impulse. But we have, as humans, we can reflect. And, you know, we can reflect on what we do. We learn from our mistakes, certainly. That's the only way we learn. And we reincarnate because of our mistakes. Now, there are those who have balanced out all their karma, have learned as much as they can, have perfected themselves as much as is possible in this period of evolution, because perfection is relative as well. Because of the infiniteness of everything, it's actually, you know, there's a point when we come to that we are given a choice. Do we want to take our reward? Do we want to be liberated? Do we want to go into nirvana? Or do we want to stay back and help our fellow suffering humanity to see the way, in a sense, to be there for them? We can't, you know, the masters don't do the work for us, but if we take one step towards them, they will certainly reciprocate. They say that ingratitude is not one of our vices. So they are grateful for the work, for the honest effort, for the sincere effort. If we're doing our best, we can do no better than that. So we shouldn't beat ourselves up if we're doing our best. So there is perfectibility. Wrote a couple of quotes down here. Maybe I'll get to them later. We do like this one. We'd like to read. It has to do with the one life, which is the interconnectedness of all. The one life that runs through all time, extends through all extent, lives undivided, operates unspent.
In the first presentation, we've heard that a proposition, of which there are three in theosophy, is an idea presented for our consideration, and it's not meant to be believed in. Rather, it's a suggestion, the truth of which has to be proven for each one to themselves and by themselves. a principle then is often a logical extension of the proposition, but it becomes a basis for our thought and action, and the validity of the principle becomes self-evident to us when we try to act and think on it in solving problems and reaching the goals in our lives. So this presentation will take a look at those propositions, or more specifically, the principles, and give some suggestions how we can go about making them self-evident to ourselves, making them our own truths. And this can at best be a very brief survey, and we'll touch on a few ideas briefly, because really it is the individual effort of life and lives that makes them a reality to ourselves. So we might say, and this is the most important thing to grasp, that there are three means by which we can make a principle self-evident to us. And one is by using the process of correspondence and analogy. It's taking something we already know for a fact to be true, and by correspondence and analogy, understanding the truth of the thing we want to consider. It's almost like a mathematical equation where there's a known and there's an unknown factor. The second method, we might say, is through our inner evidence, by using our process of observation, self-awareness, all our reasoning faculties. We can see within ourselves, within our own consciousness and awareness of ourselves as human beings, that these things are true. The book of nature is within ourselves. We don't have to turn to any outside authority to prove to ourselves that it's true. It's all within ourselves. And the third method is, of course, through personal experience. That's through our contact with nature, with the world, with other human beings. It's the evidence, we might say, that's provided outside ourselves that only confirms our own inner experience. So, as said, we're going to look through these principles in a survey, and you'll see it's really a syllabus for the rest of the year, if not the rest of the month. And so the first one is that of deity, and there are three principles or bases for thought and action which develop from that. And the first one is that of the spiritual unity of all of life. All life is one, a spiritual identity in essence of all beings. The second principle that develops from that is that universal brotherhood or interdependence is a fact in nature as we see it and observe it around us. And the third principle that develops from that is that all life is conscious, intelligent, and alive in its own degree, whether we're speaking of mineral, vegetable, animal, human, and beyond. It's all conscious and intelligent in its own degree. Life, awareness, consciousness is universal. So let's start with how we can apply these. We'll begin with the inner evidence. Is there something in ourselves that is one, changeless, constant, eternal, that can be found not only in ourselves, but can be recognized by all self-conscious beings as to being the eternal reality, the one reality of their life that is shared by all human beings? And that is that internal sense of individuality, or I, not the I of the personality, which of course we can identify with and have certain features and characteristics, but the I, the self-awareness, I am, which has no limits. It's there throughout all the experiences we go through, and all self-conscious beings can identify with it. That's what it means to be self-conscious, to be aware, conscious of I, of the self. And by applying correspondence and analogy, HBB has an expression she uses that man's spirit proves God's spirit. So that by correspondence and analogy, if we know it to be true, that there is something else and in all human beings that is changeless, constant, and eternal, that has no attributes, that always is, always will be, then by correspondence and analogy, that's what the divine principle, the deific principle is in nature and in the world around us. It is that principle which has no beginning or end or attributes, but is the basis of all. And if we want to find it in our outside personal experience, we might say that we all have the experience, the common experience of understanding space. Things exist in space, we move through space, but the space is not changed by what experiences or moves through it. It remains, it always is the same, changeless, constant, and eternal. Not only it is everywhere, but it pervades everything that exists within it. So space that we observe in our experience or can understand, all of us, is like deity. Deity cannot be less than space, but it is that universal principle which is behind and outlasts all things. Now, there are a few other principles we talked about. We talked about the principle of universal brotherhood or interdependence of life. We talked about universal life, awareness, consciousness, intelligence. And all these things can also be examined by correspondence and analogy, inner experience, and personal experience in life. And for the sake of time, so we don't take up the full lecture time here, we're going to leave that for your questions or comments later on. We'll come back to it so we can move on to some of the other propositions. So let's take then, for example, the second fundamental, which is that of law. So there, once again, there are three principles or bases of thought and action which develop logically from this idea of universal law. And the first one is that of all beings in every department of nature and all worlds are subject to the laws of cycles or periodicity in their operation, relationships, and evolution. All life is subject to the law of cycles. So how can, the second one we say then is that of reincarnation. And the principle there is that re-embodiment is a universal process affecting all worlds and beings, but more particularly in the human kingdom, it relates to the reincarnation of the soul, the individual soul being. And the third principle there is that of karma, or the proposition is that of karma, the universal law of cause and effect, which we see in all departments of nature. Science recognizes it. Every discipline recognizes it. But the principle there is it has particular application in all the fields of human experience, within, without, and in our evolution as well. It has a particular application. So these are the three principles, and once again, we're not going to cover them all right now, but just focus on the first one of periodicity and cycles and see how we can make it self-evident to us by applying those three processes. So the first one is that of the process of correspondence and analogy. So we get it, that we see throughout our experience cycles of activity and rest, waking and sleeping, birth and death. We see it in nature, as said, in the changing of the seasons. We observe it in the cycles of our everyday activity. So that's what we know. That's what we know for ourselves as a fact. Now we need to extend that by correspondence and analogy to recognize it as a process that affects not only human beings and the world we know, but affects universes, solar systems, planets. The universe itself has its period of activity and rest, of sleep and awakeness. The day and night of Brahma, as spoken of in the Hindu texts. Well, how about our inner experience? Where do we see this operation of the law of cycles? Well, how about in the return of impressions? Now, the clock may have changed by an hour, but we'll probably still get hungry about the same time as we did yesterday. Our body clock hasn't changed yet, even though the clock and wall has. And how about when we fly from one part of the world to the other, and there's a little bit of a time lag there because the body itself has a certain cycle or a certain rhythm and hasn't caught up with the changes that we artificially go through with our clock system. So very often we speak of jet lag and so forth. But even beyond that, we know that at certain times of year, related to certain holidays or maybe traumatic experiences or joyful experiences, certain memories, impressions come back again and again like clockwork and affect us. And we find ourselves going through the same feelings and emotions and experiences that may have happened years ago. So there's a return of impression, of idea, of feeling, of sensation. And of course, this is internal evidence to us. We know within ourselves that cycles operate. We don't have, even if we couldn't see the world around us to observe cycles, we could certainly look within our own conscious experience and see that there is a cyclic wave, a cyclic rhythm to our inner thought and feeling. So how do we see that in our personal experience? Well, we see that very easily in the formation of habits. We all know that we in some sense, are creatures of habit. We talked about the habit of we eat at a certain time, and so we, after a while, get hungry at a certain time, or we get tired and sleepy at a certain time. But we can use that same principle as in developing the best times to study or to work. If we apply all our energies, physical, mental, to a certain time of the day, eventually that becomes a habit and a cycle, and we find that at that same time every day, there's a peak in our powers and energies that we can use to our benefit. It's sort of like catching a wave that we've already set up in our nature. So that's through our personal experience that we can prove and make this principle of cycles self-evident to us. And like we said, we can go through the same process with that of reincarnation and karma, and we'll certainly give some ideas along those lines in the question and answer period. Now, we want to come to the third idea of the third proposition of evolution. And in some ways, this is the most interesting and perhaps most difficult, too. But there are three principles, as we said, developed from this proposition. One is all is soul in evolution. In fact, the universe exists for the evolution of soul. The third is the pivotal doctrine. That is, human evolution proceeds by self-induced and self-devised effort. And the third one is that of the idea of human perfectibility. And even though all these are important, we thought that we would highlight that last one, human perfectibility. in a way, it's probably the most important one for us to prove to ourselves, because everything around us, in our environment, in our society, in our religions, in our sciences, even in our psychology, seems to give us the message that we are less than perfectible, or that we are dependent on something outside ourselves for salvation. And so this idea that we are perfectible through our own self-induced and self-devised effort is probably one of the most important things Theosophy can put for us, and that we can make our own self-evident truth, and in a way try to help others realize it as well. So let's look at correspondence and analogy. What's a fact of our own personal experience that shows that we all can recognize as showing a degree of perfectibility? Because remember, perfectibility is relative to a period of time. Well, we all have our own particular degrees of intelligence, more specifically of talent. And it's not necessarily a matter of intelligence, but of acquired skill, intuitive knowledge. Perhaps it's of mathematics, or music, or relationships, or understanding people, or sports, understanding the movements of the body. We come into life, nobody had to teach us, but we know we have a talent, a raw talent. It's something used. Now, it can be refined and educated, but we see it around us. And so we know by that realization, that fact, that there must be a larger process of perfectibility. And how about genius? Everyone has either met or heard of or read something about a genius, someone who is so far beyond us in the perfectibility of a certain skill. That should, since we know that, we should be able to realize that the soul itself is capable of perfectibility. That one can be a genius, a true genius in their soul faculties, such as a Jesus or a Buddha or a Krishna, just as we have geniuses in the arts, in the sciences, and so forth. How about the inner experience of perfectibility? Well, all is soul in the process of evolution. Have we not witnessed throughout the course of our own lives a certain maturity in our thought, in our awareness of the world, in the feelings we have for other people? Perhaps when we were younger, all we cared about was our toys. And now maybe, hopefully, we've got beyond toys, and we care a little bit more about the planet, about the community, more sensitive to people around us. We recognize in our soul a growth of awareness, appreciation of thought. And so if there is a developing greatness of our soul, then we can understand the idea that it is possible for great souls to exist. Individuals who have perfected their inner abilities, their soul faculties, to the highest possible degree. And so through our inner experience, we recognize the idea of perfectibility. And finally, that of the personal experience of perfectibility. Well, we all see many examples of excellence on the physical, moral, intellectual planes, not just physical performance by athletes, but leaders in different countries, inspirers of people who show tremendous moral strength, and of course acquire great intellectual abilities. They have made themselves perfect in those areas, and we can see them. And so also, we also see examples of psychic phenomena, spiritual phenomena in all the different nations and races. And maybe we have met somebody in our personal experiences. Maybe we've traveled to a country and we've seen certain things that show these inner powers exist. So all this, all these different ways, through personal experience, through inner evidence, and through question, correspondence, and analogy, help us prove this, these propositions, as all propositions. So the message here this morning is every one of us already has the tools to make these propositions, these principles, self-evident realities. And once they do become self-evident realities, they become part of us and automatically a power in our life, just like movement is a power of all human beings because we have organs that move and sense. So we'll just leave it here for now and open it up for your questions and comments.
In the back.
One of the things that we're concerned about is that in regards to the lower kingdoms, if somebody, you know, we hear about the like abuse of the animal kingdom and the disregard for the plant kingdom. So we're wondering how can, I mean, and theosophy puts forth the idea that everything is soul, that to some level everything is conscious, but just to a different degree. Are there any examples of these things that we can give to people in regards to the lower kingdoms to prove to them that they should be respected because they are soul and they do have consciousness?
examples? Well, we think the earth is showing us the environment, the earth, is revolting, really, and showing us that we need to change our ways. The concept, unfortunately, the concept is ingrained to go forth and subdue and use. And when this continent was discovered, of course, there were many people living here, but when the Europeans started coming here, we thought, oh, it's just, it's limitless. We can never exhaust it. It's exhaustless. So they denuded the landscape, and we don't even know if we need to give examples so much as just to promulgate the idea that all is soul, and that these other lives are all in our system. The mineral, the vegetable, the animal, they're all in our system, and that we should be the stewards, not the subduers. And we are here to, in a sense, make the smallest footprint that we can, because, well, the American Indians, they were theosophists and they lived in balance with nature. So if we would really study what they did, we'd be a lot better off.
We appreciate that question because it does give us an opportunity to explore for a minute or two here that principle of universal life in all things, which is a principle based on the first proposition. Remember, we said there's correspondence and analogy. So the first thing you have to realize for yourself and help another person to realize is that there's more to life than their physical body. Now, some people already know that. They've woken up to that. But there, even for somebody who hasn't woken up to that, they still have the same experiences. And, you know, sometimes you don't wake up yourself. Even with the alarm, somebody has to shove you to wake you up. And in the same way, sometimes we have to help wake up another person or at least show them how to look. And so how about the fact that we all have a physical body, we realize, but we all have a whole inner life. We all have an inner life. We all think and feel and have hope and aspirations. And who of us can look at another person and see that? It's an inner reality. We call it our soul. And it moves, and it's the reason that the outer expresses itself. And it's the part of our nature that gives meaning and purpose and value to physical existence. It's what people die for and self-sacrifice themselves for their inner integrity and truth and honor and so forth, and the things they love, all these inner realities. And above all that is spirit, is the observer, the one who observes all these changes. So if there's this threefold division in us by correspondence and analogy, why doesn't life around us have a threefold? The physical we can see, the inner energetic we can't see, and the spirit. The next thing you have to help them realize is that consciousness awareness does not depend on the body and form. And we also know that because we all go through three states of consciousness every day, every one of us. We all have our waking state, and if you're talking to another person, they're obviously awake. And then there was probably a time when they were sleeping, otherwise they wouldn't be awake now, and they probably are aware of the fact that part of that time they have no clue what was on. They were in a dreamless sleep, and the other part of the time they were dreaming. And in that dream, even though the body was sleeping and they had no awareness, they were conscious, they were sensing, they were feeling, they were acting. They had a whole inner life independent of the form. And if you really have their attention, you can get to the third idea, is that there's instinctiveness in the animal kingdom, there's sensitivity in the plant kingdom, even the mineral kingdom has memory and intelligence. You can shape plastics into forms and they will remember and stay there. You can take crystals and glass and silicon and build a whole communications and digital industry about it because it has the ability to retain electrical impressions and give them off in an orderly way. And how about the affinity, the attraction and repulsion between different substances? All this shows an inner movement, intelligence, awareness, sensitivity, life, if you will. Not the kind of human life we know, but life in its own degree. We think there was a...
You had your hand up there?
Yeah. There was one particular point, and it kind of, it's all relative to what she had asked. I forget your name, I'm sorry. When you were moving through the different subjects, you said deity didn't have like a human form. But from what I understand, the way it manifests to us as humans, sometimes things on the attributes of humanity, and it's almost like the way, like that's the way the telephone works, and that's the way we understand deity. And so, roll with that principle. I listened to you go through, I guess it was about 9 different concepts in your metaphysics. You went from imagination to location, and then the balance and karma, and back down to the correspondences. It's all about going back from 5 from 9. And to me, it's easy to understand how the minerals and how rocks and that kind of thing and stones have an intelligence, and how we can help them move forward as theosophists, because the human condition, like rocks and stones, suffers from pressures. See, stones and golds and you know metals and all these precious things, or even coal, if it's not as precious, are the result of pressure. And they also have the principle of conductivity. And see, as humans, depending on how awake or how asleep we are, we have different levels of conductivity. Their ability to conduct energy, their ability to conduct intelligence, and our ability to receive and understand energy and intelligence. And so understanding a human form, understanding deity in the human form, we can actually go as far to say that the earth itself has in place its way of handling pressures and its way of handling conductivities. And the problem is for us to solve is as we remove those conductivity agents, those agents of conductivity and energy that exist in the earth, I think the earth is forcing us to actually suffer the positions that were once already occupied, so that in a way, if we don't leave the environment alone, we become part of the environment. And I think as sojourners on earth, however long we're going to be here, however long it was again we got here. I think it's important to understand those principles for future exploration of other spheres or other Earths. And I'm turning on this idea, ladies, and the reason Swedenborg and Kowalski heard me what they said. I think that's important to understand that the Earth is alive and that we can understand the conditions of the Earth through humanity.
Thank you for that contribution. What you've done for all of us, though, is you've taken that universal idea of interdependence of life and demonstrated how we can recognize it within ourselves, the pressures. We yes. can observe it outside ourselves in nature around us, and we can see it by correspondence and analogy. Just as the Earth has pressures and releases, so do we. And so, once again, you've given an example how each one of us in our experience can take these principles, make them alive for us as ideas, and put them into practical use to yes. make it a better planet.
To be fair, the conversation is to give that idea.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we're thinking of, now what can I think about that corresponds to the topic this morning? And first thing that came to our mind is the idea of what is a crackpot? And that term has been used frequently to describe a disharmony of some kind. Yet, if you go to the museum, you'll see a whole shelf filled with valuable, very gorgeous-looking crackpots. What has been done to restore the beauty in that crack, yet it's still called a crackpot?
Well, never thought of it that way. We'll say that much. But those crackpots were once whole, and they certainly had more utility and beauty when they were whole. Although we can still appreciate the beauty and imagine the wholeness because we have those powers of imagination.
With our understanding that there's a process of restoring that harmony and making and recovering it with something like that without going into the test. But they're usually shiny underneath the cracks are, but the surface is brilliant and so forth.
Well, we can only give you an example. You know, somebody may go to a store and they see a piece of pottery and it's cracked or it's broken. And, well, they don't want that. They want the one that's beautiful, perfect, because they're going to display it in their home. And that's okay. It's a cracked pot. They don't want it. An archaeologist will go to a place in Asia, Mesopotamia, Egypt, India, will spend their whole lives devoted to digging up the cracked pots of ancient people and putting them together. Tell us how human beings lived ourselves, like ourselves lived 2,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. What was important to them? How they treated women, how they treated their slaves, what they did in their free time, how they treated the sick and the poor. They put together the whole story of ancient civilization from cracked pots that we would ignore in a store. So where's the key? The key is in what you bring to the experience. Where the value of the experience is what you bring for, what you're looking for, and how you can be creative in using it.
Got it.
Well, you've said that the universe is for the experience of us all. Okay? So the question is, are we soul? Because if we are soul, you know, do we take any responsibility for that soul, that self-consciousness? You know, that ability to think, the ability to reason, you know, even the relationships of life, mothers and fathers, and, you know, our whole feeling nature is we all share. So we were told that if one wanted to become a better human being, one had to look within. And they said, if you want some help, just read the Bhagavad Gita. Just read it. If you want help, because it's an everyday process. And we're just wondering, these universal ideas, are they things that we need to consider, not only together, but on our own, to like broaden our horizon, or, you know, develop some kind of capacity in ourselves to imagine abstract ideas that really aren't, but to see things differently.
Well, we keep thinking about the crackpots, because we call somebody a crackpot when they're not reasoning rationally. It's an expression, somebody that's like, they're not acting in their own in their own interest or in anyone else's interest. They're missing a piece, as it were, of the puzzle. But we are all soul, and we need to think about that all is one, all is interconnected, that our actions, our words, our feelings, if somebody insults us and we either don't react or say something nice back to them, we're fixing that cracked pot, in a sense. We're helping it to achieve wholeness again, because we don't know what kind of baggage people are carrying around. We have no idea. And they're hurting when they react that way. They're not whole. I mean, sanity means wholeness. Sane means wholeness. So we're trying to make these ideas, these principles, are to help us find our way back to that sense of sanity and wholeness.
As souls in evolution, do we have a responsibility? This is what the pivotal doctrine is related to human beings, because there's soul in evolution in all the kingdoms, but only in the human kingdom does the soul evolve through self-induced and self-devised efforts. That's because we have self-conscious minds that allow us to see the difference between right and wrong, what is permanent, enduring, what is fleeting and temporary, to call up past experience and call up future possibilities and evaluate and judge. So we have responsibility there. And when we think about such ideas as reincarnation, yes, the idea of karma makes us responsible for our actions. But together with the idea of reincarnation, it gives us hope. Because once we set up an action, there is no power on heaven or earth that can prevent the results from that action of coming back to us. So it gives us dignity and hope along with responsibility. So that's a very important thing for us to realize. Responsibility isn't a bad thing. It's a very natural and worthwhile thing for a human being to realize if they also have the idea of hope and dignity with it. So we're coming to the end of our hour here. We invite you all next week, where we're going to consider these theosophical principles, specifically the foundation and the law of brotherhood, which we touched on today, but we'll be going into more depth next Sunday. And also on Wednesday, our study class in the Ocean of Theosophy deals with the evolution of the earth, which also follows these universal principles. Our meeting is adjourned.